Welcome to the Displacement Urbanism podcast series, hosted through the London School of Economics. My name is Dr. Romola Sanyal, and I am Associate Professor in Urban Geography at the Department of Geography and Environment here at the LSE. In this podcast series, we explore how cities and displacement co-constitute each other. As we see millions of displaced people moving to cities and millions of people displaced in cities around the world, the questions of how these processes intersect are crucial. In this podcast, I will be interviewing a range of actors, including those who have been displaced in different ways and those who are involved in the management and the study of displacement. We will be going around the world to explore the different issues around this topic. I hope the podcast offers an opportunity to open up conversations around the politics and processes of displacement and urbanization, the different ways it can be experienced, understood, and approached. I also hope that the podcast demonstrates how these are global and interconnected issues, but also one that draws our attention to its local specificities. Welcome, everybody, to this episode of Displacement Urbanism. I'm very pleased to introduce our speaker for today, Mr. Sandeep Chhatra, who is the Executive Director of ActionAid Association. He is also the co-chair of the World Urban Campaign for UN Habitat. He's also the managing editor for a SAGE journal, The Agrarian South, which deals with peasantry and labor. Thank you for joining us on this podcast.
Thank you. Thank you for having me here, and wonderful to be here to connect with you on the question of urbanity and urbanism or beyond.
Yes, and it's wonderful that we're doing this in your office in Delhi. And I know that, India and Delhi as in particular has, quite a complex landscape of different kinds of displacement. So I was wondering if you could maybe walk us through some of the work that ActionAid does with different groups of people.
To begin with, displacement is a reality when we talk of urbanism in India. And displacement is also, let me generalize it, is also has been a reality for almost all of urbanization processes in the global south. This has been a reality which in some ways has taken different trajectories as decolonization happened in different countries of the global south. Even our decolonial national movements, nationalist movements, if I may call it, or the process of what's called, what I call national urbanisms, has taken a trajectory which has been in some ways an attempt to mirror image what is the cities in the global north. So in some ways it follows that trajectory, obviously with a different logic. So yes, if you see the cities in the country today, Delhi is no exception, other metros are no exception, but even smaller cities which are modeling itself or themselves on the bigger cities, you will see those, if I may call it, those divisions, those fragmentations, those boundaries very clearly. And you have what's called the green part of the cities, those cities which continued in the case of Delhi, through the Raj days, quote unquote, yeah, the colonial days, the what is called the New Delhi of today, yeah, which is green, which might have some golf courses, which has big bungalows, and then you have another layer of the city which is sort of built up, the new built up grey areas of the city, with at the center, but also this process rapidly keeps changing, but also around. Some distant areas where you have these multi-story flats, and in all this you have these settlements, tenements, jhuggi jhopadis, homeless people who are around, who are making those parts of the city. So if you really talk of the city and displacement, this is a reality. But there's another thing I want to go to before coming to your question on what are those people that we are talking about. The reality is the thinking and the theory of displacement urbanism is important and real, but it does not sometimes recognize the other fact, which is very, very important for us, the ordinary people, their hopes, their aspirations, their reasons for being in the city, So in some ways, it does not give a central attention to the agency of people themselves, and therefore limits the possibilities of what happens for future. How do you reclaim the city? How do you build a right to the city? The kind of path, developmental path that we followed, which essentially has led to an outflow. And this has happened across Global South. We are not unique in that. But of course, population sizes are bigger here. The number of people dependent on agriculture had been very high, upwards of 70%, 80% at some stage. But even now, substantially high, upwards of 50%. So it has led to a considerable outflow of people from what is called the present small and marginal agriculture. Now, part of that outflow is expected and has to be planned for because populations grow. But a large part of that outflow also has to do with the model of agricultural development we followed, which hasn't been essentially modernization. When I say technical upgradation of peasant agriculture, smallholding farming, you know, sort of sustainable agriculture, peasant agriculture. So this led to a net outflow of people. I mean, there is data in the Indian context now. If you take the 2011 data and the migration tables were, you know, sort of given out much later, the number of migrant people, and this is economic survey data of 2017 that I'm now sort of quoting, is about 60 million. And out of that, then the annual kind of flow is around 9 million or so, 7 to 9 million, 9 million in that data set, But that tells you the set of outflow from agriculture. Now, part of that may be what's called secular migration. So people come back and come back to city again. Part of that is one-way migration. The newer side, or let's say the much more publicly visible side to it, it was always there, is the disaster-led displacement. That's huge in our context. I mean, it's one of the highest in the world. Some estimates of the international data sets will tell us about 2.5 million people are disaster displaced in India. That doesn't necessarily mean they all come to the cities. That could be inter-district migration or rural to rural migration as well. So that data is not very clear. So that's one segment of people who definitely are displaced and displaced into the process of urbanization work. We do have, you're talking about Delhi, we do have people coming into the city every single day. And the COVID waves, in particular the first wave of COVID, displayed or unmasked like the COVID was masking people, but this whole process unmasked a reality which was very macabre, where millions of people had to go back to their home in agriculture in order to survive. So you saw a huge outflow of migrant workers or people who couldn't live in the cities actually go back. So that's one big segment. The other segment is the segment which is relatively smaller in number but is only expected to grow globally, is the segment called refugees. Now they could be climate refugees, they could be refugees obtaining out of a particular political conflict, fleeing a desperate situation at home. But yes, that's a segment that, and also from what I have seen, we work with refugees here, and what I've seen is refugees prefer to come to, when they do, there's about 200,000, but that data is largely of Tibetan refugees and of what's called the Sri Lankan Tamil refugees. But there are Rohingyas, lesser in number, and that data UNHCR handles, so I don't have it offhand, but about 200,000 plus refugees in India, which are recognized refugees, numbers would be higher. And what do refugees say? So we prefer the cities simply because it gives us a possibility of an opportunity. And secondly, you know, I mean, economic opportunity. Secondly, also a sense of some degree of anonymity and protection. So there is a sense that the future of cities and the future of refuge is both, you know, is interlinked. Then there's the in situ displacements within cities. So when I am speaking to groups that we know, we work with, in the question of cities, is the third segment is those who suffer evictions. Those whose homes may be demolished. Now that happens in more in urban, but also in rural India. And that data set is not really captured city-wise. Certainly those whose homes are demolished, Human Rights Law Network of India, a social organization whose data when we had looked at, it's again upwards of about 200,000 people displaced. So the numbers of homes are 50,000-60,000 in the year 21 or so, right, to 2021. But that's another segment of people who are what would be called in the thinking of displaced people in the cities. The organization that I work for, Action Aid Association, relates with groups who are most affected and most vulnerable, in a, for want of a better word, I'd use the word oppressed within the cities. Yeah, and these groups are quite clear. So essentially migrant workers, so you have the imagery of shanty towns and slum dwellers and jhuggi jhopadis. That's the home. That's the home for them. One with the hope that they will climb up into some form of a sort of permanency, some form of sort of registration within the city, some form of entitlement to public services, possibly a rental accommodation which is more dignified, and possibly, you know, social housing if something happens. It isn't, but possibly a house of their own. And likewise, then there are refugees, as I mentioned, who would be in particular small settlements, always in a state of precarity, because you would definitely not have the rights to work. You definitely don't have an equal access to public services, health services, for instance, education services, for instance. And then there are questions within the community, women, men, children. With ActionAid, our history has also been working with homeless people. In fact, at the turn of the century, we had an initiative for the homeless people. And that initiative of support, it was called Cities for Change, or something like that, about two and a half decades ago. Delhi, Calcutta, Chennai, and Lucknow, and possibly Mumbai. Yeah, so we learnt a lot about this question. We then call those groups of people homeless, like in the UK you have homeless people. But then we soon realized they are actually, I mean, homeless is a charitable way of looking at that category. Essentially, 90% of them, except those who have not the ability to work for the reasons of age, for reasons of destitution of various kinds, extreme precarities of some kind, physical abilities, are essentially workers, informal workers of the city who do not have a sort of shelter. So we had campaigned for shelters for homeless people. We had individual members within ActionAid. I was also part of that personally. Had petitioned the Supreme Court, basis of heat and cold wave deaths in that particular time, which were happening across northern India, and petitioned and made a plea, a public interest litigation, to say that the state should actually step in and provide 24/7 shelters. Mm-hmm. For urban homeless. And after years of work on the ground with homeless people, actually running shelters for homeless people in these cities, we didn't have the resources to go in all cities, class 1, class 2 cities. But after years of that, and with some support through the leadership of the Honorable Supreme Court, one did get, and then through the policy support, policy efforts, one did get finally a national scheme of shelters for urban homeless. And that was a big victory for homeless people. We were working together with them. At least, you know, dignified shelter, that is always an aspiration. I mean, of course, there's been a progression. So most of the bigger cities now have homeless shelters, separate shelters for women as well, which provide a space to sleep, you know, sort of washing facilities, some, in many cases, meal services, sometimes paid for, sometimes subsidized for a part. And that's another debate of in terms of the state of shelters of the urban homeless. Just to say, so from this learning and from this working together with what would I would call informal workers, construction workers, migrant workers who may be in sanitation services, other forms of people in precarity in the cities, as I was explaining, What is that we learned? That the question is of building a city for future. But having said it, the idea of the people's vision of the city is to see the city from the perspective of those who are the majorities of the city, who built the city, who definitely, without any hypertexting needed for me, need a right to the city, need a claim to the city, need land in the city. So therefore, the key element of our thinking right now is to secure those spaces within the city. Spaces in terms of, let's say, land rights, securities of tenures, policies such as zero eviction policies. I mean, this is a struggle. So it's not one I can sit here and say it's done. No, it's not. So as you can see, of course, access to public services, gendered public services. Now, some of these sound like NGO words, but these are realities on the ground.
So, I mean, do you see that the city governments are responding to these this activism and the push to change the way in which they think about things?
I think the answer to your question in how responsive are the city governments, my answer would be only very partly. And obviously that depends on the strength of mass movements. It's not about NGOs at all. It depends on the strength of mass movements, the strength of articulations of mass movements, discrete groups of people affected in living in precarity coming together. But it has been successful in parts. For instance, and there we have been involved, so I can speak to it from experience, working with slum dwellers in Bangalore and a couple of other cities, about 11 other cities in Karnataka in these last 10 years or so. So the slum dwellers group, the slum Janagraha and others, and other slum Sangatne, Mahila Sangatne, they have now managed, after 10 years of effort in terms of sort of articulating the issues, getting some evidence to those issues that they are raising on the question of land essentially, collaborating, negotiating with the then Slum Clearance Board. Imagine the name, Slum Clearance Board, but the Slum Development Commissioner now, to get land rights. And about 2 months ago, we had this national workshop on urban land rights in Bangalore, and those groups and the Slum Commissioner himself was there, and he was being awarded by the slum dwellers. Because their efforts and, of course, support from the officials, the city administrators in this case, in Bangalore resulted in 4,000 people getting land titles through sale deeds, of course. I mean, the sale deeds at a very low price, I think about 2,000 rupees or so for the homestead land. Now, that's a big victory for those who were essentially living in unrecognized slums or even mostly in recognized slums but without any land titles, so subject to any form of eviction, under threat of any form of displacement, with no title to hold a sort of dignified future in place. So they've got a victory, and what was being shared there is 7,000 more such land titles were ready and awaiting distribution at a suitable time when some politician could come and distribute it. But it's a big victory. So there are those examples available. There are examples available where people have resisted evictions, partly succeeded through court orders, but mostly not. So it's a mixed scenario, and this dream of sort of no eviction, zero evictions policy, or the thinking that no eviction without prior informed consent and rehabilitation, but sadly enough, and then there are those mixed examples. For example, floods in Chennai, and we were working in flood response, but not just around flood response, but also in terms of people who were displaced. So floods in Chennai in probably 2015-16 for now, meant that those who were living in untenable areas of the city, mostly domestic workers, mostly informal and precarious workers, mostly overwhelmingly belonging to marginalized communities such as the Dalit community, the other backward castes and so forth. Now what happened, in an idea to rehabilitate, they were shifted out to Perambukkam, which is about 40 kilometers from where they were. Now, of course, housing has been given there, this multi-story housing. Of course, one can argue how housing could have been much better. But the fact is, almost all of them had considerable problems because they lost livelihoods in Chennai. So that's another challenge. Now, just last month, we had Yamuna flooding here. So what did we see here? And we were, of course, responding in terms of humanitarian relief, and we still are at this moment. Now, one has to see the space and the society in those areas. Most of the people living there are people who are workers in the city, have been migrants to the city, are in, I mean, without debate, much higher levels of precarity. So, and of course, they are the ones who lost the household articles, the Aadhaar cards, the identity cards. Yeah, they are the ones who lost work on those days. So they are the ones who suffered a net loss and damage, huge, never assessed, and badly compensated for. So what is the compensation offered? In this case, at least the Delhi government announced that it's going to offer 10,000 rupees to every single family who was affected by and who lost those stuff, and assistance to make new identity cards and other papers. But it remains to be seen, has it happened, has it not happened? Or it could be the fact that the way cities work and the kind of things that they create, air pollution for instance, or urban heat islands. Now in case of air pollution, every time high pollution happens in Delhi around the months of October, November, I mean there's a blame game starts in the media that this is on account of crop burning or parali burning as we call it in the North Indian states. But having said it, the response is what? The response is, let's stop construction work. So, three weeks. So, the construction activity is now stopped by the orders of the government. Now, those who are affected are construction workers. So, they essentially at one shot lose 3 weeks of work, 2 weeks of work. Even the contractors they are working for are not extremely upper class rich people who are going to compensate them. They don't. And the workers are often sympathetic to their contractors because when I talk to them, they say, sir, uska kya hai, wo bhi to aise hi hal mein hai. So thoda jyada hai, abhi kya hai, nahi hai. So, you know, you look for alternate work, you don't get it. The compensation offered is just to Delhi government once did announce that they're going to give 2,000 rupees or some 3,000 rupees, paltry. So, and then the costs go up. So, this whole question of impact of climate change, it does in case of floods, as I was explaining, but in case of air pollution, it leaves you in a higher state of vulnerability. Many city governments have attempted to work on land tenures, to regularize land tenures, to, in a sense, attempt to provide housing facilities for slum dwellers. It has happened. There is now a Pradhan Mantri Awas Yojana urban, but the debate is it's in private hands, so it itself becomes exclusionary, and the need is for social housing. So some of those steps are unfolding, but the point is at whose hegemony and at whose premise and with what logic. But I think that's the momentum that's needed by homeless people, for the homeless people, by the homeless people. It's a momentum needed for all the migrant workers. It's a momentum needed for all those in situ people who've been living generations in the city but still homeless. These have their own challenges. Majoritarianism of one kind presents a big challenge because it often adds to exclusionary processes. Who gets the housing in the city? Is there discrimination in the housing market? Is there discrimination in the labor market? There is. There are all kind of discriminations basis of more of religion, but also ethnicities and your class within all of these situations.
Yeah, I mean, I think one of the things that I was going to ask you, especially as you were talking about, you know, building coalitions and, you know, bringing a sort of a broad-based campaign for some of these things, is, you know, that question of how do you bring people together? Like, do you you know, do people come together, or do you, in your experience, have you seen people a bit divided because of, you know, where they come from, or you know, the particular group that they fall into? Because you were, you know, we've talked about homeless people, we've talked about migrants, we've talked about refugees, and people come from different states as well, right? And there are these differences in terms of what a person's ethnic background is, one's caste background is, and how do they work together?
No, I mean, there is, honestly, there's little to debate on that point. Beyond saying the follows, but before I get there, let me just recognize that it's quite clear that there are huge and cannot be understated pre-existing divisions. So that those can obtain from identities of various kinds. You mentioned a few, or can also obtain from what is called primacy of interests. And a phenomenon we are all in this time of neoliberal, and there is no understating that question. And that's precisely the reason why you can have a communal riot, why you can exploit those historical sort of identity fragmentations along caste, ethnicity, what happened in Manipur, for instance, more recently. It's ongoing. Yeah? So it can be exploited for and the rise of the radicalization of religion and the rise of radical religion is another. I mean, it plays on the question of religion per se. It's another sort of fragmentation that can lend itself to easy abuse and exploitation. So there are all those, and all those are at play in any given country in the global north and in the global south, and therefore in the cities of which are crucibles of what's called mixed people of all kinds. So homogeneity of cities was never the reality in the case of India, and is never going to be the future in the case anywhere in the world. So that of course exists. So what is the task? The task is essentially of defragmentation, of those identity based, of those sometimes I call class kind of phenomenon. And that task is an unfulfilled task, very frankly, and that is why we see these processes. But that is a task in the making. Do we see that happening? Yes, I see in the concrete here and now situations on the ground. I was giving you the example of Bangalore, but one can go virtually anywhere. So when it comes to the question of securing land rights, you see Muslims, Dalit communities, you see other backward castes in the case of Bangalore slums joining in together. I mean, they're not then competing that I would beggar my neighbor. Yeah? So they're joining together. So there are possibilities. Now, where do these possibilities emanate from? These possibilities emanate from building a common thinking, a common understanding of what is the problem, and the common understanding of how the system operates, how the inequalities operate, and a common understanding of what are the solutions for those. And therefore, in our experience, collective visioning, collective thinking, solidarity in action, I think this is beginning to unfold in the city from a common vantage point, the vantage point of being objects, of either nationalistic or non-nationalistic movements, being objects of state and state propaganda of some kind. So that recognition that we as people, we as common people are objectified to the various ends. Some may not be as ugly ends, but we therefore should have what we want. I think in more general terms, this seems to be emerging. If you see the resistance to evictions, I mean, it's one can argue that to the other side as well. But in general, one sees people joining in. In general, one would see people coming together on those efforts. For on another more positive side, in an effort to make the urban commons more defend urban commons, we are working in Bangalore, for instance, on the question of making the lakes livable, making the lake habitats green, making flora and fauna in the lake habitats alive. And one sees a cross-section of people joining in that defense. So the defense of urban commons, for instance, those could be public parks, those could be lakes, those could be other public spaces, offers an opportunity, not always realized. Because in themselves, that whole defense can also become exclusionary. For instance, if you see public parks in Delhi, we've had particularly those hegemonized by the resident welfare associations, one will see a whole range of exclusions. They will not allow children of domestic workers to come to those parks sometimes. Yeah, there have been cases like that. They will be exclusionary in the access to such public spaces as well. Of course, the opportunity is there, the future is there, the possibilities are there, but one has to guard against within those also these exclusions creeping up on who considers themselves as the hegemons of the city, who considers themselves as the guardians of the city, who consider themselves virtually as the owners of the city, the middle classes, the upper middle classes and the elites, and this new demon which is there, which is called the Resident Welfare Association. The question is, welfare for whom? Is welfare limit itself to a set of middle class, upper class people who reside in public housing or let's say even private housing in a land which is off for all, right? So there are these possibilities, but yeah, there are challenges, and intersectionality is always at play. To just touch on one other aspect which I wanted to, you see, a refugee is also an informal worker. A domestic worker is also belonging to a particular, mostly belonging to a particular group which is a migrant. A lot of domestic workers in Delhi are called Bangladeshis.
Yes.
So they may not be. They may be coming from parts of West Bengal which is bordering East Bengal. But who cares? But they may be also from Bangladesh or from Nepal. So there's an intersectionality operating there. That woman also belongs to the scheduled caste group in many, many cases, or tribal group. Lots of tribal girls from Jharkhand are here as young girls, as domestic helps. This kind of thing gives rise to an understanding that there's a whole intersectionality on which has to be sort of much more in the public debate and domain. And certainly there's anger, and that's where I'll stop, because if I look at cities like Johannesburg or even cities like Nairobi or even slowly cities like Delhi, you see there's a kind of, I won't call it a weaponization, but I would call it a different type of city in the last decade and a half. So you have these cities guarding against something, and you have these colonies, residential areas in a city guarding against a demon that I'm speaking of. So you will have gates, you will have guards, security guards come up. In some cases, security guards will start with the batons. Maybe in the case of Joburg, they end with electric fences or they end with guns. So where those are what is called private zones within the city, so nobody can enter. You have to have a security pass to enter, or a domestic worker has to have a security pass to enter a resident welfare association area in Delhi, because they are called terrorists or they are called unwanted elements, thieves, lumpens. So this is the reality, and in such a situation there is a huge anger. And I think sometimes anger against the oppression is also what is bringing together people in claiming the city. obviously, workers of the city are not happy people. I mean, they are happy people in and themselves. This is what I understand, that they are angry at what is this city, what is this urbanization that you guys keep talking of. All these jargon called inclusive city. So from that vantage point, there is anger. And the possibility of anger building or fructifying in a good way, which leads to a better future for all, the other part of your question, which is not exclusionary for anybody, is the need. The danger is that the anger can fructify into more weaponization of the city.
I think you've just made a really, really important and interesting point. So, I mean, I think there's a lot to sort of mull over here. And it's just the question of happiness, I think, is a really interesting point to sort of reflect on. Thank you so much. This was really interesting. And I think it's useful to sort of see all the different kinds of challenges and possibilities that come about in India, in the different cities, through different communities. And hopefully, you seem very hopeful. And I hope that hope translates really in the future into something more positive. Thank you so much for your time today. Really appreciate it. And I'm sure that everyone listening would also have a lot to think about for this conversation. So thank you.
Thank you. Thank you, Dr. Ramola Sanyal, for this opportunity. You see, a great task does await humanity. So that's why I'm optimistic.